What do I need to be good at to be great at something?
Hello, everyone. You are listening to She Leads with Carly. And in this show, we talk to the absolute best, brightest, and yes, badass leaders.
Tap into where your natural curiosity takes you. Just making sure you're not your own roadblock. Even if you do fall, you're going to fall and you're going to learn.
Together, let's build a DNA of what it takes to rise to the top and truly make an impact. I'm your host, Carly Malatsky. Hello, everyone. I am super excited to welcome our guest today, Dorothy Chow. Dorothy is the head of public affairs at DeepMind. And for those who don't know, DeepMind is an artificial intelligence lab within Google. Prior to DeepMind, Dorothy led public policy, safety, and corporate communications at Uber, Dropbox, and Google, respectively, bringing 15-plus years of experience in this sector. In her free time, she is also an active angel investor and sees this as a vehicle for social change. She loves backing diverse founders who are building for their communities based on their lived experiences. Dorothy received her bachelor's in international politics from Georgetown University and her master's in practical ethics from the University of Oxford. Super excited to have Dorothy on the show today. Thank you so much for joining. How are you? How's it going?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Carly. I'm actually back at Oxford, so this is the perfect time.
I was gonna say, that is always my first question. Dorothy, set the scene for us. So yes, you're at Oxford. What are you doing up there? What's going on?
Yeah, I'm at Oxford. I'm hanging out with some classmates from my original master's program and, you know, debating all these things in philosophy. I had a whole lecture this week on sulking. Super interesting.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So maybe we will get to that. But first, yeah. I love to go all the way back to your childhood. Tell me about who you were as a 5-year-old, a 10-year-old. What excited you at that age?
Oh my gosh. I think I was such a creative kid. That's the thing. And you know, the hard part is I think nobody tells you that post-college, a lot of your creative pursuits get pushed to the wayside because if you're super intense like I was just 150% into my job. And I think what I've missed and what I'm trying to regain now is a lot of that, what I had as a kid, which is a lot of creativity, a lot of exposure to music and art and being outside and literature. I just was such a bookworm. I loved reading. I loved like playing in the world of like my literary characters. So yeah, that's the kind of kid I was. Super verbal, not felt like I was just never good enough at like the math and science type stuff. So the fact that I ended up in science and tech is something that my parents still laugh about. But it is what happened.
And I know at this age too, so you said not into science and math, but from my understanding, you actually went to Georgetown thinking you may go into pre-med. Is that true?
Pre-law or pre, I mean, this is the thing. When you grew up in an Asian American household, like those are the options, right? You're going to be a doctor or a lawyer. And I just wasn't, I knew I wasn't suited to it. My parents both being in drug discovery, my brother is a doctor. And I always knew I wanted to do something in basically the humanities. So I thought I wanted to go and become like an international human rights lawyer or something like that. And I think partway through, I just realized, you know, I'm not sure I want to keep doing school. Like I went to school and I studied international human rights. A lot of that has to do with a lot of pretty gruesome stuff. And you kind of are drawn to it because you believe in justice. But when you're in school, you're learning about it. You're writing all these papers, but you don't feel like you're having any impact. And so I actually ended up graduating a semester early, partly because I was like, I just can't keep having all this stuff on my mind, but not doing anything about it. And so I ended up graduating early. And because I graduated into a huge recession, and because I wasn't sure that I wanted to keep doing school, I ended up saying, you know what, maybe I can figure out law school later if I want to. And I never went back.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. Also, I can relate a lot to even, so I'm Jewish, right? And that's also very similar. Pre-med, pre-law, like very those are the similar. Two paths. And I, very similarly, my family of doctors. So I was like, you know what? I guess that's what I got to do. But anyway, when you discovered first of all, when did this passion for politics or ethics, when did that, if you look back, when do you think is the first point of, you know, origin and the interest there?
I mean, I'm always the kind of kid who is asking, like, why? And I think I was a really sensitive person. And okay. So when something that bad is happening to someone else, my mind immediately goes to, oh, but, like, that shouldn't be happening. Why is that happening? And, like, what made it okay for that to happen? Like, if these were things that I was always thinking about. My dad used to play this little game with me where when I was, like, a toddler, if I saw someone sad on television, he would say, Dorothy, what's going on? And I would just get really sad. And I'd be like, that person's really sad. Like, it's wow. really hurting them. And I think I just, over time, I tried to steel myself to that, which is why, like, I think I'm somebody who has a lot of energy. And so the active energy makes you want to be like, I'm angry about it. I want to do something about it. But I've learned also, like, that, you know, as a kid, when you feel that, like, oh, that's sad, that's really sad, like, learning how to cope with that and turn that into something that inspires you right. is a whole, like, navigation of that process, right? Yeah. So, yeah.
So at Georgetown, I could definitely understand how, given that passion, that energy could be, you know, could go towards law, right? And solving it in that lens.
Totally. Yeah.
But walk me through. From my understanding, you decided maybe managing consulting, you had an offer there, and then something else came up. Walk me through that process. How were you thinking of your career long term?
I mean, we all go to school thinking we're going to save the world, at least if you're like me, you do. And then Georgetown is all about social justice and living for others. So I was like, yeah. And then I was like, I really don't want to take the LSAT. I am a horrible test taker. I get really nervous. I have a high anxiety. I really didn't want to do it. I think writing has always been a good outlet for me. Like, if I were like an essay test, I'm fine. But the multiple choice thing, I was the kid who took like the SATs way too many times, cause just thinking I could always do better. Oh, I'm not doing some like other tests. That's just not what I can handle right now. And so I just kind of wrote it off. And so when I did that, and I felt like it was like losing a little bit of my compass on what I wanted to do. And I was watching everybody go through this like major rush towards management consulting and banking. And back then, this is like 2007, 2008, it was super prestigious to go into those fields. And I was like, well, clearly, since I don't know what to do, I should do what everybody else thinks is prestigious. So I'm going to go to interview and this huge fall rush. And I did. I did like the morning interview, the evening interview, cried in between, cried afterwards. And then I just think, like, you know, you get these case interview questions that are like, how many golf balls can you fit in a school bus? And then, like, I look at that now and I'm like, you're just basically teaching people to bullshit and be confident versus actually understanding who they are and do they have the skills and the passion and the values it will take to do this job. So it's interesting because now those questions have been known to be bad for women across the board, right? It's like a well-known thing and they don't, I think they don't ask those questions anymore. I was just intimidated out of my mind. And so I did end up with a consulting offer, practice those interview questions with a good friend enough times. And then, so I thought I was going to go do that in the fall. And then I ended up graduating a semester early, like I said, unexpectedly. And my parents were like, well, you're either moving home or you're going to figure out how to support yourself. And I was like, oh crap, I didn't think about that part. So I applied, I remember I applied to work at Anthropology at Coach, thinking, you know, I could do retail for a bit and see what, like, just take a break.
Need a job.
And I applied to Google. And then I applied to Google in Washington, D.C., and they had just opened their office. It was like 10 people. But I didn't know any of the context at the time, right? I was just like, whatever. It seems like a great opportunity if I could get it.
Yeah.
And they gave me this internship, and it came through very quickly, which normally, if you know Google at that time, they dragged out every process that would never have happened. I actually got the offer for that before I got any of the retail offers, which is crazy. They kind of just put me to work as a full-time intern. And part of the reason why they gave me that job was because they're like, she already has a job. So we don't have to worry about like convert, you know, she's not looking to get anything else after this. And about halfway through that internship, they asked me if I would consider reneging on my offer for consulting to stay. And I was working basically with the McCain and Obama campaigns and a lot of other congressional campaigns at the time in DC on just using YouTube and other unpaid Google products. So not the ad side, but like Google Docs and spreadsheets. Back then it was like all new.
Right.
To organize a campaign and reach voters. And now, I mean, now we have a totally different problem on YouTube. But that was the gig and I just loved it.
And so, okay, before we even go down that route, I am so curious, looking back now, right, and even reflecting on that experience, going through the interviews of management consulting, I think actually those questions are still there, even for like product interviews and whatever it may be. And it's so fascinating just hearing you talk about it, because I think such a big part is that confidence piece. So I think, like you said, for women, it may be harder, which is a whole discussion in its own. But looking back now, what advice would you almost give people who also feel that pressure that they should go down this path? It's secure, you know, it's a good job. Everyone else is doing it. How do you think about that versus saying, you know what, maybe my passion is going down another route that is maybe less secure? So how do you think of that?
Oh my gosh. If I could, I 150% think that the greatest thing in life that I feel now is living in alignment with your values and your beliefs. And if you can do that, like if you can express that through the work that you do, no one can take that away from you. And I've been so privileged to be able to build my life that way. And I don't think I would trade that for anything. And that it does take resources to do that. So like, that's something to consider. But there's some strategies you can use to think about, like, there's a reason why I didn't go to nonprofit, even though I care a lot about the world, right? And there's, so I'm happy to chat through all of that. But for me, like, this ability to live in alignment with my convictions is it just gives you such like a grounding and a peace around how you work. And that's what I would say for that.
I love that. But I'm going to double click on it and say it's actually, it seems very challenging, right? And especially at a time in your life where, you know, you're trying to discover a lot of things, let alone, you know, about you and what you believe in. Is that something you had always? You knew what you valued, you knew your convictions, even at an age where, you know, so many external factors, you're becoming an adult officially in a way. Yeah. How do you think through that? How do you really touch with yourself and like, what are your values?
Oh my gosh. Well, to be fair, I was a very insecure person in my 20s. I think all of us are just trying to figure out who the hell we are. And
exactly,
I also was someone taught to always go towards the facts and what is safe versus taking risks. And I think a lot of women are taught that, especially women of color. But I think that society is okay with men taking risks and failing, much more okay with that than women taking risks and failing. And that's just, you just have so little margin for error. So you're taught to go for like the safest bet possible, which is why we might march towards, you know, banking consulting seems safe. But I had a really good friend from Georgetown who's kind of like my older brother. We're still very close. I remember calling him and he had gone into finance and he actually really liked finance. He was one of those rare people. I called him and I was like, Alex, I don't know what to do. Like Google's offering me this spot. It's actually going to pay a lot less. At the time they did pay a lot less than my management consulting offer.
Yeah.
I don't know where this is going to lead. What should I do? And he just goes, Dorothy, do you enjoy your job? Like, how do you feel about it? And I was like, I love it. I love this job. I love learning day to day. And he goes, do you know how rare that is for somebody right out of school? Like in the first 2 years, right out of school, you love your job. He's just, you just got to do it. Like you just have to do this. And it was the first time somebody had intervened and just said, like, how do you feel?
Yeah.
Does this feel good to you? Because if it does, go with it. And like, I had not been taught to trust my feelings and my gut like that before. So that was just a really big moment for me. Yeah.
I love that. And it seems, it's so funny looking back because it seems so simple, right? Do you enjoy it? It's a simple question. Like, and yet
basic.
It doesn't seem to, right. Oh, that's so fascinating. So walk me through Google. You decide to renege your management consulting offer. You are going 110% into Google, you know, a small team in DC. What were you doing? How were you, what was your day-to-day looking like?
Well, at that time, like I was the youngest person in the office. And so I was doing whatever they told me to do. But I would say the biggest moment for me when I was like, oh my gosh, this was definitely the right decision. There's two actually. One was I got to go to the Democratic National Convention, the first Obama convention. And that was just it. Google back then is not the Google it is now. And so what that was just like introducing people to a tech run campaign at all. And the idea that you could bring the electorate so much closer to the candidate through social media and other things. Now there are concerns with that now, obviously, but back then that was so novel and it felt like we were, you know, democratizing access to information truly, like about candidates and about the political process and getting more civic engagement through the internet. So that felt so amazing. So that was point one. And then the second thing that happened almost immediately was Google decided to pull out a lot of its operations out of China and make a big announcement about it. And so for me, this was like the best opportunity I could have gotten. Like it was all hands on deck. I got the chance to work with our vice president of like policy and comms at that time and write our testimony for Congress for why we left China and all the human rights issues that we had discovered and all this information about privacy and security of user data and Gmail and what that might mean. And it was like baptism by fire. Like I wasn't sleeping. I was writing speeches. I was hardly eating. But it felt like, wow, I'm so passionate about human rights. This is what I care about. I'm Taiwanese. Like this is amazing. So that was my first big moment. But yeah, that was a lot of what I was doing, which is like going up to meet people on the Hill and in Congress to talk about our positioning on this and why it mattered, briefing executives, writing speeches, writing our testimony. And so for me, it felt like, you know, everything I said about, oh, I'm working on like studying atrocities, but I'm not making a difference. This felt different. This felt like real impact and moving the needle.
Absolutely. Do you think looking now, you know, throughout your career, do you think people who have similar passions to you, right, either whether it's human rights, whether it's public policy, whatever it may be, do you think there still needs to be a better bridge or a, you know, bigger bridge between tech? Like, is that the first thing that people are still thinking of as I could go through tech and make that impact? Or is it more so the maybe conventional approach? Because in my mind, I think it's actually still its own sector that you don't think about necessarily. But how do you think through that?
I mean, I didn't know this job existed when I was at Georgetown. Had no idea. I'm truth be told, like they were fewer and further between back then. There are definitely more companies now hiring people with policy backgrounds. I think that policy can be an incredibly relational and translational job in tech. What you are trying to do is build trust in the and earn trust from the public in the tools that you're building. And a lot of that has to be done in partnership with the public sector. I think traditionally tech is very averse to politics and regulation, but I think to a certain degree, you really only get responsible innovation when you partner with the public sector. These people are elected officials. Elected officials should be one of your biggest user signals because they're literally elected to represent your users. And I think people don't take that seriously enough. And there's so much work, to your point, that can be done to narrow that gap, especially for people who care deeply about democracy and the future of how society works. It's not just tech that is building that. And certainly tech should not be doing that on their own, right? It should be something that we agree on together if it's something that's going to impact all of society.
So I can go a couple, obviously, different directions here. But before I even go to, you know, you went to corporate communications, led that at Google, and then obviously to Dropbox. So we'll get to that. But you were almost at the very forefront of what this looked like from a policy aspect in tech, right? With, you know, campaigns and presidential campaigns, whatever that looked like. Looking now, do you think there is something fundamentally missing at these early stages that need to be addressed, given that, as we've seen, it can go in a whole spiraling effect? And that actually can be applied in any domain, right? Whether it's, you know, Instagram, when it started, they weren't thinking about, you know, the number of likes is, you know, validation and self-worth and mental health, whatever it may be. How do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, as you know, I work with a lot of founders now from an angel investing perspective. And one of the biggest things I look for when I'm looking to make an investment is this founder somebody who sees the entire ecosystem and is thinking about their role as somebody in that ecosystem, or are they just looking to build for themselves, right? There's a big difference in the way that founders orient themselves in the world. And the way a friend and I often talk about it is like, you know, that optical illusion where everybody sees a rabbit, but then some people see a duck. I'm like, I want to find the person that sees a duck. And often the person sees the duck is somebody who's been through a different life experience that has caused them to see the duck, or is like, has done a lot of self-reflection and about why they're doing what they're doing, which is enabling them to see the duck, or like is really curious about why this thing operates this way and why, what are the power dynamics, the social dynamics and the economic dynamics that make it move that way. And so I do look for that. And I think inherent in that kind of founder is a predisposition towards what is my product or service going to do in the world? And how do I steer that impact so that it is, you know, equitable, so it's largely beneficial? How do I handle the risks if something goes wrong? Because it will go wrong. Software always has bugs. What am I going to do to help address the issues that are raised? Like, that, those are things I really do look for in a founder, rather than build and get the biggest valuation, because a lot of these valuations are fake.
All facts right there. And I can see it too, you know, working at Floodgate, we see it often, right? It's who is just, you know, those technical builders, which they could be absolutely, you know, brilliant at building, but then it's that level deeper that you just mentioned, which is so important. I love that. So Dorothy, you end up going to Dropbox and leading corporate communications. Before we even go into what is corporate communications, what does that role look like?
Corporate communications is just all the media relations and the like public profile that you're giving the companies. I actually see it as broad reputation management is kind of what I see as that. You're managing how the company is seen by business reporters, by you know, people who will otherwise set the tone of the market and have an opinion about your how you guys are operating. And what you're trying to do is give people access to the information inside the company so that they can weave together that narrative and that story. And as much as you can, you know, I always say that companies largely get the reputation they deserve. So it has that external component. But I actually think a lot of what I try to do also is ask the companies the questions around, okay, so do you have a good answer to why people should trust you? Do you have a good answer to why people should use your services and why this is going to be a stable investment for people? Like you have to have good answers to those questions. And a lot of that comes from, I think, strong values and culture. Those are the core components of reputation. Like the communications part of it is like the gloss over all of that, or it's like the icing on the cake. But if you have like bad ingredients in the cake, it's not going to taste good. So a lot of it is working both internally and externally, which people don't always recognize.
How do you balance the ensuring that you're building a great reputation, you're getting the, you know, the great messaging out there, but also with being very ethical and trustworthy? And, you know, because unfortunately, I think what we've seen with tech, maybe I have the pessimistic view, I don't know, but we've seen, you know, there's, you know, a kind of infringements of privacy, and there's so many things at play here. And it's only going further down that path, maybe. But how did you balance that of saying, okay, you know, this is very important that we send this messaging out, but also ensuring that we're building trust and we're building in the most right way?
I think that comms is such a great role, because what you can really do is hold up a mirror to the founder at the company, right? And say, this is what people are seeing. Is that what you're okay with seeing? And I think it's a really cool role that way, because often when decisions were being made at each of these companies I worked at, no matter what role I was in, I would say, okay, well, here is the external perspective. Either I would ask somebody external what they thought, you know, in a much more veiled way, like hypothetically, blah, 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 blah. Or I would just, you know, kind of surmise based on my experience with a lot of people outside the company, hey, this is how this is going to reflect. Is this what you want? And is that okay with you? Because sometimes, depending on who you're talking to, sometimes we're like, yeah, whatever. But a lot of times, I think it's a way of appealing to their better angels, to be honest. Like, it is sometimes something will sound one way in your head. And then when you say it out loud, right, or when you play it out, you're like, I'm not sure anymore. And having that reflexive kind of practice is just really important regardless. But I think for a comms role to be meaningful, what you're trying to do is earn trust. And, you know, a lot of times companies say, oh, that was just a misunderstanding. They were misunderstood. And I'm like, they were misunderstanding what I did. Were they really? If you really ask that hard question, were they misunderstanding or is that just what happened? And are you okay with that? Because you have the ability to change if you want to. And so a lot of the decisions that were being made at these higher levels, is around, I feel like it's a really cool position from which you can have a lot of impact if you want to.
And so at Dropbox, and then afterwards you decide to go to Uber. I would love to walk me through almost your thought process, changing companies, and obviously I would love to hear your Uber experience. But first, walk me through, what were you optimizing for? How did you determine, you know, this is the next step for me and I'm ready to take that next step into a new company?
So my biggest lesson, I will say, no matter what role you're applying for or going for, is that at the end of the day, your quality of life is determined by the people you're working around. No questions asked. But that is just the number one thing, no matter how much they're paying you, no matter what title you have, that is the number one thing that defines your day-to-day. And so when I went to Dropbox, the kindest people. I mean, it was just an amazing exec team. Ramzi Hamsani, who is now a founder as well, was my general counsel, and he was leading a broad set of teams that I was had the privilege of joining. I worked for a woman who I'm still very, very close with, who's now in venture. And so it was just a cool group of people. And it was all interesting because it was a really bunch of early stage people. So a lot of them are now all in VC or founders themselves. And so I was only at Dropbox like 18 months or less. But I feel like the relationships I built there are now ones that I've completely gone full circle and circled back to, because a lot of them are in AI or they're in VC. And it's just such a cool network to have. But so when I went to Uber, which is interesting because it's all about people, I was talking to an executive who I'd worked for previously at Google, and she had gone to Uber. And she got on the phone with me and I said, look, I don't agree with any of your political positions at this company. And I've also heard horrible things about working there as a woman. So I just really don't think this is for me. And she just looks at me and she goes, you know, Dorothy, you care a lot about the world. And this company is going to have a huge impact on the world, whether you like it or not. So either you don't do anything about that, or you come here for at least a year and stop throwing rocks at glass houses and see what we can do together. And for me, I was like, that's so compelling. So I went and I ran consumer protection and safety there, but it was really about looking at every single one of their processes, especially up to like leading in the intention of leading up to them going public, and thinking, what do we do about this? So one of my interview questions that they asked me was a bit like a case interview, which was, one day we're going to have a volume of rides every day at which there will be at least one person or more getting into accidents, being assaulted. That's just what happens with running a huge company with people in small spaces. And how are you going to deal with that from a policy and comms perspective? So that's the kind of thing that challenge that I was thinking a lot about. And I thought it was worth going for. So yeah.
And then through that time, almost this woman that you talked to very much prepared you in a way, because it was hard. It was a hard experience.
Very hard.
Yeah. First, what was the most challenging part of working at Uber once you actually got their hands dirty?
Most challenging part was that I'd only worked at Google and Dropbox prior to that. And it was early Google, early Dropbox. I had not worked with an exec team where we had fundamental values disagreements, like real values disagreements. And I had not worked, certainly not at that proximity, with executives who we just like did not see eye to eye. We did not share the same principles at all. And yet I felt like the product was interacting with so many people that I felt like this moral obligation to just say what I needed to say. And I'd never worked on something where I was dealing with people's daily lives, right? Like cloud storage and like Google products at that, they're still pretty far away. Email, like, you know, docs, like, right. It's still pretty far away from like real life situations. This was like logistics on the ground. And so, you know, every time they asked me something about changing safety protocols, because at that time, what they were looking at was they felt like safety costs was just equal to a background check, which onboarding drivers was probably the most expensive part of the business at that point in time. And so they were looking at all the different ways to streamline that. And I spent a lot of time thinking, like, am I not going to convince you with the number of like assaults and deaths on the road? I mean, accidents and things like that too. Like, am I not going to convince you with that? And then I thought to myself, okay, the thing that matters to them is the bottom line. So what I did was I got the litigation team and the insurance team to put together their costs. And then I said to them, okay, here's a new formula for safety. It is litigation costs plus insurance costs together minus background check costs equals the actual cost of safety on this platform. And that was the thing, one of the things I did that started to move the needle towards a different formula. And what I was learning there was like actually really valuable, which is in most parts of your career, you are not going to sit at the table with people who entirely share your values. That is going to happen over and over and over. And so how do you, while holding on to your values, bring people along? Like that's a leadership skill. Leadership is actually about bringing people along who also disagree with you. And that I'm really grateful for having learned there.
From there, yeah, that's a lesson that you can take really anywhere. And not only that, I think something else that you can touch on is almost accepting that there are a disagreement of values, but it's realizing that they're not understanding the pathway of your thought process. And maybe mm-hmm. you need to show them a different way to get there.
Yes.
You know, and so yes. there could reach an agreement or an understanding, but maybe it's just they're not in your line of vision and they need a different
exactly.
packaging, if you will.
Yes.
Which is super interesting. And beyond that, almost when you look back at Uber, you said it yourself, right? It was not, you know, fun per se. It was hard. It was challenging. How do you balance ensuring that you're sticking through with a job because either you're learning or growing or whatever may be versus saying, you know what, it's actually, even though it's been short, or you know what, I need to actually remove myself because I'm being affected, either my mental health or whatever it may be. How do you balance the two?
Totally.
Hats? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that calculation can change over time at the company, right? I think there's questions I ask myself, like, am I making the difference I want to make? Do I see the impact coming from that relative to the amount of energy and time spent? I think that for me, output really matters. And so am I getting out of like this in the world that I want to see what I'm putting into it? Do I feel like this is a tenable situation that's not, to your point, not toxic and not harming my mental and emotional health? I think towards the past few years, I've really, really had to level with myself around what is good for my mental and emotional health and what's not. It used to just be like the last thing I thought about, and then it just catches up with you, right? I've probably like had high functioning anxiety and OCD my whole life. And when you're younger and in more junior roles, it actually really helps you because you're just really on top of it. And you're like high performing, great, I can get this done. I'll stay up all night. It'll be fine. I won't sleep. And then over time, that just accrues and it takes you down because you can't possibly be on top of everything. And if you do, if you are, then you'll become a micromanager and no one wants to work for you. And so all the things that made you really great in that phase of your career are not necessarily going to take you to the next phase. And so you have to start thinking about phase transitions. Like, what is it that I need right now in this time? What are the skills, experiences, and knowledge that I'm accruing? And is it what I want? Because if it's not, then it's probably time to move on. But for me, even though like there were so many moments where I really did not like my job at Uber, like it was fun, I was still like learning tons of new skills, right? Like I learned a lot around like executives are not gods. They're just people and you have to level with them. So that, I lost all my fear of that. I think I learned a lot around, had a ton of experience. I had to testify in multiple different hearings across different cities and states. Knowledge, like I was learning so much about, the two highest costs in American households day to day are housing and transportation. And so transportation matters a lot. And there's a lot that that company can do and is really interesting. So I was learning so much day to day that it made sense. And then I got to the point where I was just like, I am out of gas. And I don't have the thing that it's going to take to go through this next phase. I remember thinking to myself, because Travis had just left the company and they were looking for a new CEO. And I was thinking, if I want to stay to really make a difference next, I have to stay for at least 2-3 years to really see them through this next phase. Wow. And I just don't think I have it in me to do that. And so that's why the next transition happened.
Yeah, super interesting. And I think it's so important, and you touched on it, is very much stepping outside of yourself in a way and being true to yourself, right? And recognizing, okay, this is where I am growing or I am learning, or even like you said, right? You wanted to have that impact at Uber, but you realized it has to be another 2-3 years and that's not sustainable for you. So now leading public affairs at DeepMind, and obviously take me through this process. I can assume from your story that you are so driven by this ability to make an impact at almost a wide scale, right? Like Uber, you kind of knew going in, but then you also, that girl, she said one thing of how, you know, it's used by billions of people. And you were like, okay, I have to do it. So walk me through your process joining DeepMind and being almost at the forefront of this crazy new technology that's kind of taking us by storm in a way.
I mean, when I was thinking about DeepMind, a lot of what was running through my mind was, I just believe so deeply in social change the intro that you read. And I was thinking about what are the fastest vehicles for social change. And at the time I had talked to a whole bunch of people and it was really interesting because it was back when AI wasn't that hot yet, but they were like, you know, that's where a lot of the energy and interesting policy work is going. And sometimes I think it's also important, what I recognized at Uber was that when policy is existential to the business, like at an Uber or at an Airbnb, and you're working in a regulated sector, there's a different feeling than when you're working at a company where it's like, well, maybe it'll get regulated. And so what I saw with AI a little bit was we need to build a lot of the institutions now because this thing is going to affect every regulated sector. I'd worked in self-driving related policy right before I left Uber. And all I could think to myself was, oh, this is interesting because you're literally constructing everything fresh in this industry that hasn't happened before. And I saw the chance to do that with AI. And that's what really got me going. I was like, oh my gosh, instead of like reactively dealing with stuff, I get the chance to build something completely new and set up the infrastructure for this industry. Like that's going to be great. So I wanted to do a lot of that policy infrastructure work so that we could think about what are the right ways to really usher in, like if technology can be used in ways that benefit people so you make more equitable outcomes happen, what would that look like? Like what is required for that to be the case? And so that's what inspired me, I think, to move in that direction.
How important is having a technical background needed for having these informed decisions and making these informed decisions, whether it's about public affairs, ethical decisions? How do you think through that? Because when I look at your background, I see the technical experience purely from the companies you've worked at, but you also studied, you know, public policy at Georgetown. So how do you balance that? How important is it?
I think you have to be curious about it. It's not that you have to have like a PhD in machine learning to be able to do policy work on AI. I don't think that's the case at all. In fact, I didn't really know anything about AI before I joined the company. But I think what I developed over my time at Google and Dropbox and Uber was like a genuine curiosity about what made the business work. I think when I was at Uber, I was one of the first people to ask somebody to map out the entire structure of how pricing worked at the company. And he was like, oh, that's something you want to, I was like, yeah, I need to know. I want to know the ins and outs of how this works in every city, how it's like, and I'm that person who wants to dig in to find all the facts. And I think that makes me want to read the papers. Now, I think that women are often intimidated out of those situations and environments and are made to feel small and like, oh, she can't possibly be technical. So like, she's not qualified. But that doesn't mean I don't bring something different to the table. And that if I understand enough of this core, I can tell you, for example, how the FTC might regulate you. Like, that I do know how to do. And that is valuable information right. from running this business. And so I think it's learning that, for me, it was learning that like, oh, I have something to add and I can grok this. Like, I do think I'm a quick study. And so I've been able to wrap my head around, you know, information security when I was at Google. I could wrap my head around privacy issues and certainly wrap my head around a lot of the other drivers for what we now would largely consider content regulation policy, which is one of the biggest things out there. And so a lot of that has to do with understanding social science and the world as much as it has to do with understanding the technical specs. And if you can put the two together and be conversant, you'll be fine, which I honestly think most people can do. I think we give people way too little credit and way too many barriers to being, you know, able to participate in the tech ecosystem, honestly.
I love that. And I'm so happy you said that. And even going a step further, and you mentioned this briefly, but what do you think needs to happen to ensure that we're getting more diverse voices, whether it's women, whether it's people of color, whoever it is? How important is it? And who do you think is responsible for pushing that change?
Oh, gosh. I think that anybody with a bit of privilege, it is your responsibility. And I think people need to be like, the thing I think I get most fired up about is not necessarily the status quo, although it's upsetting that tech is so not diverse and extremely male dominated. But I think the hardest part for me is like, how do you not see it? Like, how do you not see that on this decision-making email that is not a single woman involved? How do you not see that, you know, when you draft a press release, you have six quotes and they're all from men and not a single woman? Those kinds of things just drive me crazy because it is so blatant. And then I think as a woman, when I was coming up through the industry, even if you just pointed out a fact, for example, if I said, or if like just an observation, no senior women were in this meeting or spoke up in this meeting. It just feels so loaded to observe that and say it when it's just a fact. And so I just wish people in privileged roles would be more aware of that, because it starts with awareness. And then once it becomes part of your like daily lexicon, you can't help but not. I can't not see it. It's like it's everywhere to me now. And I think a lot about what it takes to create an environment that feels safe and comfortable for people to want to participate and walk into. I mean, I remember actually really significantly when I was at Uber, the former Attorney General Eric Holder had come to give a talk, and I was with the people staffing him. And this is in San Francisco, so at Uber headquarters. And all of these people were going up and taking selfies with him, and they were all white and Asian, basically. And then I turned around, and it turns out the kitchen staff, the security staff, everybody who was Black and brown had stayed late. And they were just gathering in the back of the room. And he looks up from all of these photos that are happening and he sees them and he just looks at his staff and he goes, push my next appointment back an hour. And he just walks straight down the aisle and goes and just like starts like chatting it up with them. And I just start crying. I just started bawling. I was like, I can't, because it was so stark in that moment that the spheres that we're living in are not the same and it's not okay. And it shouldn't be that way. And I'm part of this, you know, and how do you become a leader like him who sees them and sees that and wants to create that bridge between the divide versus one that like is just okay taking the selfie? Like, that I think is such a big moment for me. And I've loved working for leaders who see that.
Wow. I love that. And I think it's so important even just to share these stories. I think the power of exposure goes such a long way. And so I love that. And I'm really happy you shared that. Okay. More fun questions, if you will.
Sure. But
Dorothy, yeah. I would love to know, what is your hottest take?
My hottest take. I was thinking about this when you had added in like a convictions thing. And I was like, well, controversy and conviction is, I think, what you put. My most controversial thing is I love ancient traditions. And so I have a weird, funny thing about astrology. I love it. I think it's amazing. Okay. I think no matter who you are, it's a great prompt for you to think about what's going on in my life and why is it happening? And so I love it. I love all kinds of ancient myths and traditions. Ooh, and astrologies and like different like woo-woo things, because I just think they must have known things that we didn't. They didn't have all these distractions in their lives. And so I think that's the funniest thing about me is I'm super woo-woo, even though I work with a bunch of scientists. Yeah.
I love that. Okay. So I have to ask, what's your sign?
Sagittarius sun sign, which is, I think goes with all the philosophical and travel. And then I am a Leo moon and rising. So all fire.
Okay. So I wouldn't even be able to tell you the sun versus moon versus rising. I think I've looked at it at some point, but I do know I'm an Aquarius born in February. Woo! That's the extent. So
that means you get along.
Yes.
That's a good match.
Okay. Well, there we go. I think you're right. I think it's a factual, you know, I believe it. So yeah. Dorothy, what would you say is your superpower?
Oh, I think my superpower is connection. I think it's so much more powerful than control. And so when I think about managing teams, a lot of what I think about is like, how do I connect with this person? How do I understand where they're coming from? How do I like help them realize what they want and what their goals are, and then give them the skills, knowledge, and experience to get there. Like a lot of what I think about is like, if no matter where you work, whether it's for me or somebody else, like I just want you to feel like the confidence that you can land and you will be great.
Yeah.
And that is, I think, the biggest thing. And I think you can't do that with someone unless there's like a connect. Although I think it's easier for some people to manage via control. And I've experienced that personally. My mentor and friend, I think, just changed the way I see people management completely because of that. And so that is now how I think about, but yeah, that is now my superpower, because I think it's the thing that means the most to me. It's how people feel day to day around you at work versus like, the work will get done. Like you hire good people, the work will get done. But how you make how people feel around you as you're getting that work done, that's the difference.
I love it so much. And I think that actually comes up, the power, like empathy, having empathy, practicing empathy, improving, growing, whatever that looks like. I think that is such a powerful thing that I've seen incredible leaders like yourself kind of embody. So I love that. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved it and I really appreciate it. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me, Carly. It's amazing what you do. So thank you for inspiring all of us to share. It's not always easy to do that. So thanks for creating the space for it.
Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. If you enjoyed, please spread the word. Tell someone about She Leads or post about it on social media and tag us. If you want to contact us, feel free to send over a message through the She Leads Instagram page at sheleads.show. If you want to follow us on Twitter, our account is at She Leads Show, and mine is at Carly Malatsky. This episode was produced and edited by Nick Furschow. Thank you also to our partner, Floodgate. If you're passionate about startups and want to learn more about the starting journey of those who have built groundbreaking companies, I highly recommend listening to Starting Greatness with Mike Maples Jr., the founding partner of Floodgate. He has an incredible show that, in my opinion, is definitely worth your time. Thanks again.